Hello, I'm Ingrid Kohler, and welcome to LGIU Fortnightly. I'm not alone this time. Hi, Jonathan.
Hi, Ingrid. It's great to be back on the on LGIU Fortnightly. It feels like ages since I've done this. You've been valiantly doing it alone throughout these weeks.
I have been, and it felt like the right thing to do then. But of course, there was a simple technical solution to be able to do this. We just had to apply the thinking. It's Jonathan Carr West, our chief executive, everyone.
Yes. Hi, everyone. I'm Jonathan Carr West from LGIU. Yes, but I think you've been doing it brilliantly. So I now feel, I now feel I might spoil it and the sort of pressure to be amusing and interesting that I don't normally feel. So, you know, will this be an advance on your solo recordings?
You cannot spoil this episode because we have some great interviews lined up.
That's true. There's a limit. There's a limited amount of damage I can do. That's always good to know. So yeah, well, as you say, some great interviews lined up. What are we going to be hearing about?
We're going to hear from Councillor Abby Brown. She's the leader of Stoke-on-Trent, about how she's shifting emphasis around the pandemic and the thinking that she's been doing. And we're also going to hear from a friend of mine, actually, somebody who's lived through the Ebola epidemic in Sierra Leone and what it feels like to live through an epidemic and come out the other side.
Right. So probably one of the few people around for whom this isn't the scariest public health experience that they've ever lived through.
Interesting. Well, you know, listeners will have to find out whether they think that this is scarier than Ebola or not. They're very different experiences.
Great. Another cheerful podcast from the LGIU.
Look, we're laughing.
Worse than Ebola. But I think all of that reflects kind of where we feel we are in the progression of all this, right? So, you know, at LGIU, you've been leading on a lot of our work, you know, in an immediate response to the pandemic, to the lockdown, doing briefings for local government about what is going on, you know, what's the government doing, what are the different responses, how does this affect different aspects of local government policy and operations, the daily pandemic bulletin that we've been putting out, you know, trying to help people sort of see what a global picture of how local government is responding. And I guess, although we are still, you know, in the lockdown phase of this in the UK, we're starting to sort of see some marginal easing of that, but we're still very much in that space. We're looking forward to, you know, will schools reopen in June or not? Some will, some won't. That's actually quite a big local government story, with some councils sort of flexing their muscles on that a bit and saying we're not going to reopen, including some quite surprising councils, and a lot of councils saying we're going to leave it to schools. This is a choice for head teachers. You know, we're just starting to move into a sort of what's the next phase of this, it seems to me. And for local government, I think that's actually where some of the more difficult stuff comes out, because in a sense that the sort of immediate response to the crisis was difficult to do and required a huge amount of work and a huge amount of sort of valiant effort from local government, but they knew what to do. Whereas now I think we're starting to ask the question about what comes, I was going to say afterwards, I mean, there may never be an afterwards, but what comes next? What comes on the other side of this immediate bit of the crisis? And how does that sort of shape our world differently? And how does it shape all our lives differently? And how does it shape local government differently? And that's what we really want to focus on today.
Absolutely. I think it's probably worth just hearing straight from Abby.
I'm Councillor Abby Brown, and I'm the leader of Stoke-on-Trent City Council.
How are things in Stoke?
Well, I think they're going reasonably well. Like most places, I think we've all got used to life now during lockdown. And obviously things are easing. A little bit of concern for us certainly over the last 10 to 7 days has been around our accelerating rate of infection. So I guess you could say we're a little bit behind the curve of certainly London and the West Midlands. But we are hopeful, you know, that as we advance forward, things are going to level off a bit for us.
That must feel quite weird. I'm in London, so we've, you know, it feels for me like we've got past the worst of it, looking at infection rates in London.
but I know that it's not the same everywhere. And my family in the U.S. don't live in one of those hotspot places. So, you know, I watch the curves for them, which are still growing, and it's concerning.
Yes, absolutely. And I think, you know, it's a difficult balance as a leader of the council, because you want to give people confidence that things are improving. But on the other hand, you want to be very honest with people about the situation that we're in. And I think it's been a bit of a balancing act for us over the last week, because obviously the government have announced that things would be easing. And we're kind of saying, yeah, that's OK, guys, but let's not go overboard here. But I think in general, you know, people are quite nervous at the moment in terms of going out. We've all got our own kind of parameters of what we're comfortable with. For me, I haven't been in the supermarket for somewhere like 8 weeks, and I'm a bit kind of, I don't really need to go to a supermarket because I can go to my local store and they've got everything I need now. So I guess we're all building up our confidence a little bit more to get back to life in the new normal.
Whatever that might look like. And I guess you're starting to think about what the new normal is going to look like in Stoke. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah, we have. We started, I think we probably, a lot of us started a number of weeks ago, but kind of in a more formalised way, started to look at it a couple of weeks ago. And for me, I'm involved with chairing our own recovery group within the council with our senior officers and a number of my cabinet colleagues. But I'm also involved with our local LEP task force, as well as at other levels being called into various meetings with organisations as diverse as Arts Council England and also the LGA, really. So I think people are interested in what happens moving forward, and clearly they want a range of views and opinions.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, it does look different in different places. What are the things that are proving really helpful in recovery planning right now?
I think in a strange kind of way, bearing in mind that I know that everybody is working really hard, is almost the space to do it. Although there's lots and lots going on, and you know, it seems that not a day goes by when we don't have a new bit of government guidance, I think there's a strange kind of space that's a bit of thinking space. You've got to try and work it into your day. I know that that's really hard. But because we're operating in a slightly different space, you know, colleagues of mine are not travelling into the office, so you're gaining time like that. But also operating in different environments where you don't have people perhaps around your desk in the way that you might do normally. So although it's really busy, there is that kind of space to think about stuff perhaps. And I guess the other thing is that's come out of this is those new and different relationships, certainly for us, and I'm sure for many, many other councils, a lot of unexpected partnership working that's come forward, groups that you thought couldn't do it, who surprised you because they did and they were amazing, partners who you thought you were fairly keen on working with, but actually they proved to be brilliant, or equally partners who haven't stepped up and you thought, I'm going to step past you. So I think there's operating within the framework that we are at the moment has probably been the most helpful bit in a number of different ways.
It definitely reframes the way that you think and do things, for sure. It has for us as well. But also finding that there's things that we wish we knew that we didn't, that we don't know and don't know necessarily how to get. Are you finding that as well?
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, as you look at kind of what new normal looks like and where you're going to go to, there's a kind of element of trying to understand things that as you say, we don't know about. In a city like Stoke-on-Trent, where car ownership is relatively low, you know, previously we've been pushing really hard on things like public transport, and clearly that's going to be important for us still. You know, coronavirus is not going to change the levels of car ownership within the city, but it does frame it in a very, very different way than we had before. And I think it's trying to understand that. And similarly, you know, as a city, lots of emphasis on walking and cycling to places, which again, in a place where there isn't huge car ownership, does happen. But again, it's hard to model that because previously in the past we've been hilly, so it's been people who walked and cycled out of need, whereas now I think there's a growing feeling that it's something people want to do. So how does life change therefore around that? And it's really difficult to model, isn't it? Something that you have no idea what's going to happen.
What do you need for recovery?
I think we all need money as a starting point in terms of how you move beyond where you are. I think there's probably an element of continuation of space. I think, again, one of the most frustrating things over recent weeks has been the absolute barrage of paperwork that comes in. And I jokingly say to my officers when I get another email with another diktat that says, fill this in, I was like, because this is just what you need, isn't it, at the moment, as you're trying to deal with a global pandemic, another form to fill in or another narrative to provide on how we're doing something that actually we're just cracking on and doing. So I guess there is probably that, a need for a bit more space. And of course, the money. And I suppose probably a feeling that other people are thinking the same. And certainly I know within local government and probably within the wider public sector and probably beyond that into the business world, people are thinking very differently. But I think it would probably be nice to know that maybe at a national level, there's some of that more open-minded thought that a lot of us are having now. I know that they will be under the same pressures as we are to operate and to communicate to the public. But I think it would make it a much more interesting conversation if we felt that what we are going through at the moment in terms of thinking about recovery is also happening at a national level in the same way.
Right. And in terms of like that relationship, I mean, do you feel that local government has, where you are anyway, has enough power or enough freedom to reorganize things in a different way?
I think it's a really interesting question because there's quite a lot of tensions there. I was talking to somebody the other day, an economist, and he was saying to me that, you know, maybe there's a feeling from the government that they've pulled a lot of levers because we, you know, we're in a kind of command and control type environment where the government is saying, we need to do this, pull the lever, and it happens. And that gets a bit addictive. So I see that part, but equally I do see other parts of it where actually there's quite a lot of freedom to do stuff. Now, okay, granted, it's within specific parameters. You can design your own scheme in terms of discretionary business grants, and clearly the more guidance that comes out, the more you realise you probably can't. Mm-hmm. But equally, there are kind of discussions going on with ministers around what happens with devolution in September. You know, I think there's a kind of an interesting tension there, and it will be interesting to see where the government goes to, because actually you're right, we do need much more freedom if we are to do this, and freedom means not giving us guidance. You know, back to my busy support grant discretionary example, it's discretionary as long as you follow the guidance you're given.
Yeah, that sounds like the way I parent. you have the freedom to make the right choice.
Yes. Yeah. And I guess a kind of ticking clock as well. You know, I think some parts of government have worked better than others around this. We all know there is no roadmap is there for doing this. It's really difficult to kind of understand what happens next for everybody. But you know, that kind of element of they give us something and sometimes the guidance takes a little bit of time to come out, and that's fair enough, I kind of get that. But then it takes some time for the guidance to come out and then them continue for the next 3 or 4 days to send you stuff. And I think that's when it starts to get quite frustrating. But you know, that's not a representation of all parts of government. I think it's just been really challenging for everyone. There's no guidebook on this, is there?
No, I think there are some things that are, you know, reasonable to criticize about, and then some things that are like, gosh, yeah, you know, this is going to be, it just is hard and the situation changes. And so you do have to refresh guidance sometimes. What's your next big, what's the thing that's really worrying you right now as we head into this kind of new phase of normal?
I think it is probably how things do kind of happen as things come back to life. I guess in a kind of in a counselly type way, it's fairly easy. You know, clearly we're spending a lot of time thinking about services coming back, but you kind of ultimately know what you're going to go back to. And I think it's sort of how things evolve for everybody else around us. As a city, we're fairly lucky in a way, and for once, some of the things that often in the past we've talked about being disadvantages now turn out to be opportunities for us. We're a polycentric city, so we have multiple centres. Mm-hmm. which in the past has been really difficult because they've competed at times against each other, whereas now when you're talking about social distancing, it's actually an advantage because we're very well spread out. We have lots of green space as well, and we don't have some of the challenges that other places have where they have very concentrated areas of people in the centre or in one or two centres. So we have those things that are happening, but it is kind of understanding how we get there and how that works. And you know, we have a mixed economy, but actually will people want to come here? any longer. And I know really that in the bigger scheme of things, that's a small complaint for somewhere like Stoke-on-Trent, you know, much more so for coastal towns and cities. But actually, I think that's what is probably the biggest worry. Will people want to even go in and shop in the local city centre? If I'm worried about going to the supermarket, how will everybody else feel?
Yeah. Yeah. It does feel like shopping as a diversionary activity, as a fun thing to do. I mean, that's just, it's not fun right now.
No. No, not at all. I think things do move on and you get used to stuff, don't you? You know, I remember in the first week of the lockdown going to a supermarket and one of my friends said to me, what was it like? And I did go to the supermarket the first week. And I said, the lights felt dim, there was no music on. And every so often they would just play this kind of, you know, please keep away from other people, please annotate what you need. And the shelves were empty and it was almost in some kind of post-apocalyptic era type thing. And he said, well, that was good because they don't want you to go. And I think things have clearly moved on from there in terms of supermarkets, not quite the same. But I think, again, it's how we get back that sense of places, isn't it, which will be easier for some places and, as you say, for some sectors than it will be for others.
Yeah, absolutely. We've been hearing from a number of our members that information flows between health to social care, between central and local governments, has been difficult. What's been your experience on that?
I think probably between health and social care on a local sub-regional level, it's been really good actually. And as I mentioned before, I think in terms of relationships, massively helped to improve, do things, and certainly given us a very different eye on how we want to move forward and how actually we can do it in a much more collegiate way than needing to kind of be organised in a very formal way, which is maybe what we preferred before. I think kind of communication up to central government has at times been quite difficult, you know, and I guess it's that strain, isn't it, of things. I'm sure everybody can reference this in their own life or in some way, you know, in the same way that you get to the point with where your kids, you're fed up of homeschooling them. It's really difficult. You don't understand what you're doing. The lessons are really hard and the kids are struggling as much as you are. I think there's an element that perhaps we've seen a bit of that. You know, the beginning of the pandemic, we were being invited regularly to webinars and to telecoms with ministers, and they've kind of dropped off a bit. And I remember the last couple at times, I wouldn't say bad tempered, but, you know, kind of people feeling quite defensive about where they were, but I'm starting to see those pick up again and being invited back to more of these, and the spirit is kind of returning in terms of the wanting to work together. So it's going to be natural, isn't it, that there'll be difficulties with data, and you know, I think that as we've progressed through this, the tone of approach has changed quite a lot to acknowledge that there's difficulties on both sides sometimes, and talking stuff out is actually quite helpful.
Excellent. And that's really I mean, that's very positive to hear. If you were going to give advice to other councils, or something that you've learned in Stoke-on-Trent about recovery planning, or if you just even have a question you want to know, what would that be?
I guess I would probably choose to give a little bit of advice, and guess it's advice from somebody who, I'm a relatively new leader, albeit I've been a cabinet member for a few years, and I'm always keen to try new stuff, but I'm quite nervous about doing it. And for me, one of the things that I have learned during this is that this has been a great time to try stuff in a kind of fairly safe environment. The example I would give is that I always enjoy doing my comms work for the council, but I've tried lots of different things with my officers who are keen to just have something different to do, because actually it's a bit of a diversion. And actually we found that the response from residents has been very different at this moment than we would have probably expected outside this moment. So it is almost a kind of a bit of a safe space to have a go at doing things a bit differently, because people's opinions out there are very, very different at the moment than they might be. So push those boundaries and have a go.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Abby.
Okay. All right, speak to you soon.
Bye.
Okay. Bye. Bye.
Fascinating interview.
Yeah, really interesting. Kind of maybe not what I was expecting to hear. I'm not sure what I was expecting to hear, but that real emphasis on thinking space.
Right. And obviously that's something that, you know, we always try and provide at LGRU. One of our kind of USPs, I think one of our reasons for being is that we say to our members, look, you're all you know, in normal times, you're all deep in the weeds of delivering day in, day out. You know, you're overloaded with stuff. It's very hard to find the space to kind of look up and sort of take a deep breath and think more broadly about where we're going. That's always difficult. You know, I think it's quite interesting. You know, one of the things we've been concerned about is that in this sort of emergency situation, that could get even more difficult. But actually what we're hearing from Abby there, and I think what we've heard from some of our other members is that no, actually somehow in this people, you know, it is also, it's creating a need to sort of respond and you know, people are working really hard and really stretched, but it is also creating spaces for thinking as well as a demand and a clear need for that. And people really recognizing that part of emerging from this is to think quite extensively about how they do things differently.
It's certainly prompted a shift in the way that I've been thinking or how I structure my thinking. I still have to, you know, work to find space to actually do that thinking. But it's like a creative process where you're kind of jarred into looking at things through a different light, through a different lens. And so I can think about problems in a different sort of way. But yeah, you still need that kind of structure on what you're thinking about. And sometimes some days are great, you know, I can really think and, you know, make some strides ahead on some of the stuff that we're trying to do. But other days, honestly, I'm very distracted.
Yeah.
And I find it difficult to focus and difficult to remember what it is that I'm supposed to be thinking about. You know, I start doom scrolling and,
yeah,
you know, it's one of those things. And that's part of the reason why we wanted to create a framework for thinking about this.
But I guess there are different phases in all of this, aren't there? I mean, I found myself in that position more in the first few weeks of the crisis where I was just, you know, not getting very much done because I was just kind of endlessly, I didn't know that word, doom scrolling. That's where you just sort of scroll through Twitter kind of feeling despair about the world, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I didn't have a word for that, but I have certainly done it. Or just, you know, turning on the TV news all the time, even though you know that it's still the same questions, you know, you're kind of hoping if I turn on the news one more time, there'll be some sort of definitive piece of information that will kind of unlock sense-making on all of this. And I think I don't know if it's just sort of fatigue around it, but I think I've slightly moved beyond that. I haven't been sort of turning on the news as much. I mean, maybe that's just a kind of trying to shut things out. And in part, I think it is a kind of deliberate attempt to focus on the future. But I think you're right about that sort of dislocating effect, or that you know, that this does kind of jolt us into a different space, which is creative, but which is also disorientating. So what falls away is a kind of structured conceptual response. And that's certainly what we've been hearing from a lot of people in local government. So that, you know, it's probably worth saying a little bit about what we're trying to do at LGRU to support that. Because that's a message we heard quite clearly from a lot of our members, is that what we, you know, we don't want, our, you know, we know that no one has easy answers. You know, the world is full of people writing sort of, you know, think pieces and op-eds about, you know, how coronavirus will change everything. And I guess as an aside, if I was being a bit cynical, I would say that you know, you could summarize an awful lot of those by sort of paraphrasing it as basically, you know, why coronavirus proves that I was right about the world all along.
And yeah, absolutely. I think, yeah, I've written a piece like that.
Yeah, no, we all have, right? We all see what we want to see. So yeah, one of the things I see is that this, and I think this is true, this shows that we need, you know, much more localized decision making. We need local government to be in the front line of coordinating sort of place-based responses to that. I believe that's true. I believe that, you know, this crisis does show us that. But, you know, equally, I would say that, wouldn't I? You know, that's what we, yeah, you know, we all have a tendency, I think, and this is just human, right? That we have a tendency to see in the contours of the pandemic the sort of shape of the world we want, and to see it kind of. Pushing us towards a reframing of the world in the way that we all already wanted. And, you know, that's normal, but I'm not sure it's that helpful to other people. So, you know, what we've been hearing from our members, I think, is, look, we don't want someone to provide us with the answers, because there is no one set of answers. It looks different for everywhere. we don't want people just to make sort of predictions about how the world is going to be different post-COVID, because actually those may or may not be true. And if they're not, it's not that helpful. There is no kind of necessary end to this. It will be, it's not set in stone. It will be as we make it. You know, there are decisions to be made and choices, and we need to shape it. So what we want is a sort of structure through which we can ask the right questions, and a sort of framework in which we can start to think through what are the issues that we need to be addressing, what are the big questions that we need to be asking, how do we start reimagining what local government is and what it does in a sort of post-COVID or a sort of ongoing COVID world. And setting that out as a sort of structured framework of questions rather than a set of kind of I told you so sort of predictions is what, well, that's what we've been trying to do, because that's our best interpretation of what people have been telling us would be useful.
And we have it on the website already.
And you may well have seen it on the website already.
But it's not all filled in though.
No, exactly. So this is, I mean, without sort of going too much into our kind of inner thought processes, what we wanted to do was to be both tight and loose, because we didn't want it just to be about everything and nothing. And we wanted it to be, you know, tightly focused on the questions that local government needs to be asking. But we also wanted it to be loose in the sense that we wanted to recognize that there are different perspectives and that there will be different and it is sometimes competing points of view on all of this. And we wanted to be loose enough to host different types of output and different types of response, so that we could have quick responses through blogs, through briefings, through podcasts, but we could also have longer term responses through some research, through partnerships with academic organizations, and we could have a space for our members to respond and to respond to each other and to create a dialogue. So the questions we want to ask are around the location of power. You know, what do we learn from all of this about where decisions should be made, what the best kind of level of government to be doing different things is, the reset that everyone's talking about, you know, how do we think differently about sustainability, about skills, about jobs, about the things we value in all of this, and how do we capture some of the benefits like cleaner air and, you know, less traffic? You know, a lot of people talk about that, but what does that really mean? We want to think about place and community. What have we learned about them? You know, there's been a huge amount of community spirit generated by this, but you know, will that continue? What are the levers? What are the mechanisms for sort of locking that in? There's a lot of unfinished business. You know, local government was in crisis before this. You know, finance, social care, devolution. We're not making any progress on any of those things right now because we're all dealing with coronavirus. Well, that's fine, but actually all of those problems were getting worse every day pre-COVID. They're still getting worse every day. You know? So what damage is being done in the meantime, and how do we pick all of that up, you know, when we start to emerge on this? Related to that, you know, trust, governance. You know, we went into this crisis in a scenario where trust in public institutions is falling. What will happen as we come out of it, and how can local governments sort of start to work to put community trust back at the front line of everything it does? And finally, you know, what does that mean for local government as an organization? You know, can we kind of construct a new municipalism out of this? Can we think about a different role for local government, how local government functions as an institution? You know, how it functions as a culture, as a workplace? How do we, you know, do we emerge as different organizations at the end of all of this? Big, big questions to which, of course, we don't have the answers, but we want to host that debate. We want to sort of slot contributions into that framework over time so that it starts to build up to be a really comprehensive dive into each of those areas, which we think are the key framing questions for local government as we emerge from, you know, at least the first phase of this pandemic.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we're already starting to shift a lot of our output in that direction. So a couple of weeks ago, on the kind of anniversary of the elections, or not anniversary, on the, you know, when we were supposed to have elections.
The ghost elections.
The ghost elections. We did a piece called Democracy Deferred, where we look at both what's been happening in response, either postponing elections by a short amount of time or a long amount of time around the world? And what happens when elections go ahead, as they will have to do? How do you run them safely? How do you make sure that people aren't disenfranchised? How do we make sure that democracy is vibrant? Because that's a very key question. Obviously, I'm an elections geek, so I spend a lot of time thinking about that. But we had both some practical suggestions from around the world, but also some questions about how we go forward, because democracy isn't just voting. It's about a big engagement.
Absolutely. And of course, that has looked very different in different places around the world. So we postponed our elections in France. They went ahead with local elections in other countries. Yeah, there's been a lot of different approaches, and that's fine. You know, there's no right answer. So, you know, but what's important is that we try and learn from the pros and cons of what different people are doing around the world. And that's something that we've been trying to do more generally, of course, you know, through our pandemic bulletin, you know, looking at different local government responses in different places in the world, and trying to kind of draw out some interesting lessons around that.
Yeah, and I would absolutely encourage people to sign up for the bulletin. We're picking up some amazing lessons from around the world, trying to pull through the insights as everyone is asking and seeking the answers for those same questions that we just talked about. If you want to sign up for that, it's free for anyone. Just go to lgiu.org and make sure you fill out the preference form. Tick the box that says that you want to hear from us more frequently, and make sure you tick the COVID-19 topic, and we'll continue to share those stories from around the world.
Absolutely. And talking of learning from around the world, that's probably a good intro to our second interview, which is kind of extraordinary in that, you know, you talk to someone who's been through another really kind of scary public health emergency, and focus, you know, in a very different part of the world, and we look at what lessons we can learn from that.
Yeah, I had a chat with my friend Amanda Bangura, Mandy. I used to play rugby with her, and I talked with her and her husband Aruna. They were in Sierra Leone in 2014-2015. I mean, I knew that Aruna's from Sierra Leone. I didn't quite realize how much they were involved in the Ebola response. I don't know how that passed me by at the time. Maybe I would have been more worried if I had known. But they played a direct role in responding in terms of food security, but also community action. And I had a chat with them about what it felt like to live through that, but also what it feels like to come out the other side.
Let's hear it.
Hi, I'm Mandy Bangura. I work for a program that's funded by the UK government in Malawi, the Department for International Development. We work to both prevent and respond to violence against women and girls.
Yeah, hi, I'm Aruna Bangura. I work for the World Food Programme during the Ebola response in West Africa. So we are mainly providing food for quarantine homes and some vulnerable communities.
Right. So you were both living in, you're from Sierra Leone, and Mandy, you were also living in Sierra Leone during the Ebola crisis that I think a lot of our listeners will remember. And in fact, you moved there during the crisis, as I remember. And obviously, full disclosure, friends, I wasn't happy about it. I'm worried about it. But you're fine. You're still with us here today. So for most of us, for me, for almost everyone I know, I've never lived through anything like this before, but you have. How is this different? How is your experience of living through this pandemic different from that epidemic?
I think probably two things. Firstly, I think because on a personal level, I've had that experience before and I've lived in the midst of a pandemic previously, I think I was a little bit what's the word? Desensitized to it. So when it first came up, you know, all the, I was very familiar with these kind of processes like WHO sit reps, situation reports, and the pandemic curve, and all of these kind of phrases weren't very new to me. So I was almost reflecting on my friend's response to this hitting the UK and my own kind of observations or responses, my gut feelings about it. And I could see in them that initial, they were kind of going through a similar process to that which I went through with the Ebola response. Like, what pandemic curve, flattening the curve, what cases, transmission, R rate, what? But to me, I guess I was just a bit like, okay, we're here again. Right, that's fine. Let's just get on with the business of dealing with it. So I kind of think that that was one difference for me. Desensitization to risk, of course, not a good thing, but I think that that's probably what I was experiencing. And then I think the other key difference is because the transmission method or way of it transmitting is so different with coronavirus to Ebola. So the response and the way that we have to change our behaviours and the social distancing, that's totally, totally different. I was actually reflecting recently, yesterday in fact, on some work we did in Ebola, and I was looking at like photos of these huge gatherings of people, and that was actually quite normal. You know, we pulled people together, and we so in the Ebola response I worked on the social mobilization work, so I was coordinating a program that supported about 2,500 young people to work in their communities to trigger changes in behaviors so that people would not undertake behaviors that led to further transmission of Ebola. So for Ebola, it was around burial practices and caring for sick people and kind of reporting when people were ill and that kind of thing. So we pulled those young people together to train them on how to facilitate those behavior change processes. That was completely the norm. Like, you'd have your temperature checked before you were allowed to go into a room or into a building, but there was no kind of long-term do not engage, do not speak, do not, you know, interact with people physically closely like that there is in this pandemic. So it is very, very different in terms of the things that we as people have to do to reduce the transmission. That would be my 2 pence.
Yeah, I think it's almost the same. Like, I think the pandemic actually came up very unexpectedly, and it was lightly treated before. Like, we started hearing from China like it's really something funny, like, oh, it's a flu, maybe it's nothing. So for me, like, I never thought something would come up more worse than Ebola. But, and also I was very contemplating the way people were talking about Ebola and this coronavirus, because I still feel like Ebola was a bit more dangerous than Corona. Mm. But looking at the infection rate or the way, because, well, Corona now, well, I learned when it was declared pandemic, because Corona now is quite difficult because of breathing actually can transfer this, because Ebola before, except somebody has to be very, very sick, ill, before it can be transmitted. So later I started hearing now this information, blah, blah, blah. But like Mandy said, the big difference is Corona is more, I mean, the social distancing is more being communicated and kind of treated seriously than Ebola. Because in Ebola, of course, workshops were allowed, people were still allowed to meet, although, but with checking temperatures, some kind of measures and things that to put in place. Whereas Corona, like, you don't know at all, because somebody who is infected is hard to be detected because they are quite active, maybe within the next 21 days or even a month, some people. So that's the key difference, because since you don't know, I think you definitely have to avoid these crowded places or whom to interact with or whom not to interact with. So that's the big difference for me, because during Ebola, of course, social distancing was not more too stricter than Corona. Mm. Corona is more stricter, I've learned, you know.
Do you know, actually, you saying that has reminded me, if I may, just one similarity that has come to mind. Mm-hmm. This learning as we go was similar with Ebola, as we're seeing in Corona as well.
Like, yeah.
The
yeah.
medical advisors and the scientific advisors saying, actually, we don't have the data yet. We can't tell you that. We don't yes. know that. And I remember with Ebola, at first there was this question whether it could be transmitted through sweat.
Yeah, sweating, handshaking.
Yeah. And
breathing was not actually mentioned because that was,
yeah,
it was said, it was not respiratory disease. So so Corona made it more dangerous because it's respiratory.
Mm.
So I think, yeah.
But this idea of kind of figuring out as the data comes in and then having to change the measures and the response, you know,
the strategy
in line with that learning, that I think I'm seeing as a parallel in both situations. Yeah.
Not that there haven't been some other flare-ups of Ebola in other places. Ebola is not gone, but that epidemic is over. It finished. You lived through that.
Yeah.
How does it feel to come out of that? Because I feel like, you know, we're at this kind of turning point now in terms of our attitudes, that we're going to live with it, hopefully live beyond it. But I still don't know what to think. What should I think?
Okay, so, well, I can recall the day that the epidemic was declared over in Sierra Leone. Because of the incubation period, the country had to experience 42 days of no new cases for the epidemic to be declared over. And that happened on the 5th of November, if I remember correctly, yes. 2015.
Yes.
There was a huge party. It was, I remember going down to the beach in Freetown, Lumley Beach, and it was just packed full of people. Obviously, we'd been counting down, so it was like day 40, day 41, and we'd gone on we'd started that countdown a number of times, and you'd get to like day 10 and be like, oh, there's a new case, you know, so it wasn't easy riding. But I remember, I think people, by the time it got to maybe day 35, 36, 37, people were starting to think, okay, this might actually be it. This might be the end. And there's this big party on the beach. And I think I remember it getting to like 2 a.m. Now, remembering that we'd been working up to like 2 a.m. for the past 18 months. So like, it wasn't weird to be awake at that time, but it was weird to be awake and partying, not working. I remember that. But then, of course, in the January, was it? There was a new case in the January?
Yeah, there was a new case, but I think it wasn't too serious.
Yeah, I think there was not very many.
It was just like the impact. I mean, that was they were referring to it as post-Ebola impact, blah, blah, people were. I think even one of the cases was that I think the person was infected once, but I think,
I can't remember the details,
because I don't know, it was related to sexual stuff.
That what it was?
Yes, it was like a sexual intercourse, and then the other person started feeling differently, and then it was said, blah, blah, blah. But I think it was just like a stigma, or somebody was very panicky. So it wasn't really, really that much scary again. So that's how we just went through it.
Yeah, it kind of felt, I think we were all waiting to see if there were any cases of transmission.
Yeah.
And I'm probably remembering incorrectly now, I'd have to check, but I don't think there were, or maybe there was only one. It was
there only one something, yes. It was related to, in fact, the other victim was provided counseling. I think she was really scared that maybe it's that, because she started feeling some symptoms like cold and blah, blah, blah. They tested indeed, but some people were, you know, so many conspiracy theories, some people were just traces of blah, blah, blah.
And yeah, there was a lot of conspiracy theories. But it felt actually quite a positive experience in a weird way, because you saw the systems working like they should have been working throughout the past 18 months. So they found the case, it tested quickly, they got the result quickly, they quarantined quickly, they tracked all the contact tracing, they called it. They did that well. They tested those contacts. They found the one. And basically, they contained it. And it was like, oh,
squeak,
we can do this. So that was, in a weird way, a positive experience to see that these systems we'd been trying to strengthen the whole time were actually working well now. And then actually, really quickly, things just...
Got back to normal.
They really did.
People were doing some better. Although there were some post the Ebola monitoring, post Ebola monitoring system, because that's how the surveillance system, the Ministry of Health set up a surveillance system. It became serious now because during Ebola, there was no effective surveillance system, disease surveillance system in place. I think that was the time even the animal surveillance system also was strengthened. Organizations started to support because I think in some way they said there was some kind of way animal can transform. And since you don't know the status of animal, because we have so many POEs that are crossing points where they cross with animals, goats, sheep, this kind of thing. And it was like a possible means of transforming disease. So the government decided to set up that they were doing some really, really good monitoring and then weekly updates. I think up to this time when I was working with that consultancy, they were doing weekly updates because there's all the information gathered for the week is being reported on the Wednesdays by the surveillance system to show the data, how many Lassa, how many this, how many that. I think Corona definitely has topped the chart now. With that,
focus on Corona. So hopefully we'll get back to normal. But when to do so, I suppose.
Do you think that? I mean, obviously, better that it never happened at all. But I think there's a lot of talk of people saying things like, "Well, let's not go back to the old normal. Let's change. Let's learn." I mean, obviously, Sierra Leone has a very complicated history. You know, fairly just before, you know, not just before, but within, certainly within living memory, a lot of violence just before Ebola. So were was there a kind of desire to change things? And did the thing, did things change?
I think for me, to be very honest with you, well, in professional institutions, like I was working for the UN, definitely, even after Ebola, we definitely were practicing the usual Ebola measures. Like we still have, I could remember when I was living on in 2018, we still have buckets outside with sanitizers and soaps. So it was not Ebola time. After Ebola, people were still encouraged to wash your hands when you come maybe from lunch or when you went out to do some transaction. We were doing that. And then so also because our sitting structure, I mean, remained the same during, because during Ebola, it was rearranged, not really sitting closer. And then we maintained that still because for professional institution, I believe you still need to do that. You don't, you, even though the Ebola has passed away. But with like the rural area and customary way of dealing things like culture, I think slightly, I could say it changed just slightly because people were even happy when after the Ebola, because they wanted to continue doing their burial. And we have this secret society because people were starting just like this currently Corona, you know, like for the Bondo, the women's society, there are people who find pleasure in that, like the dancing. It's a whole kind of organization. People enjoy, you see strangers coming from even overseas to participate in those kind of things. For them, it's their livelihood. So make them kind of resume again doing these things, and then they are buried. Because burial even, it's a kind of like time when you meet people you have not met for quite a long time, like family member, because they travel to go there to participate with the burial So this is a time like a happy moment, people discuss family issues. So yes, slightly, although people change, I cannot say, I can even say like 20% or maybe 10%, 15%, but so it's quite different from the professional institution. Professional institution kind of remain 50% and then go back to their normal 50%, but with traditional, you could say 15 to 20%.
And you're talking specifically about the behaviors relating to transmission, right? So like hand washing and that kind of thing.
Yes.
I think for me, my reflection would be that I think Ebola kind of galvanized society a little bit. From speaking to my Sierra Leonean colleagues and to Aruna and people that, you know, friends and family there, well, not so much family, I think maybe more within the sector that I worked in, people started saying that this is a demonstration that citizens can genuinely push through change. We, you know, there was a big recognition that it was citizens who ended Ebola. Yes, they needed the health structures and you know, the all of the systems and the institutions that kind of led the response. But if citizens didn't engage and didn't change in the way that they needed to, then Ebola would still probably be, well, maybe not now, but it would have lasted a lot longer. So there was this kind of energy kind of coming out that, you know, collective action can work and we can do things that contributes towards national development and we can respond to a national emergency. And I feel like that has kind of carried on quite well. Following the Ebola response, I then worked on a program that was all around supporting citizens to engage more with their local councils, primarily local elected representatives, to hold them to account for service delivery, health being one of the services, but also education and social protection. And we were trying to address this kind of despondency and this apathy, I suppose, that was kind of, I would say, quite entrenched. And we would refer back to Ebola all the time. You know, look what young people did in the Ebola response. Look what communities did in the Ebola response. Look what citizens achieved. Let's apply this to long-term development. And, well, I was part of the program, so I'm really quite biased towards it. But we did a lot of evidence that it was working. So I think that would be my reflection in terms of longer term change. And I suppose the other thing I would say in response to your question, Grid, is, you know, I've heard a lot about building back better. I think that's a phrase that's being used a lot in the COVID response, certainly I'm hearing that in my professional circles at the moment with regards to VOGUE in, violence against women and girls in Malawi. And I'm sure that idea would resonate with people in the UK as well, particularly your kind of your listeners. If they're thinking about policy and services at local governance level, then I'm sure there'll be a lot of learning that we can do to build back better, protect people better, you know, ensure that services are available that respond to survivors of violence. I'm sure there's a lot we could do.
Absolutely. And thank you so much.
Thank you.
Wow. I mean, that's amazingly interesting. Lots of food for thought there.
And I have to say, I kind of messed this one up because normally when I record interviews, I record the whole thing. We take what we want out of it. But because I was trying to combine an interview with just a friendly catch up and, you know, rugby girls, I thought there might be some stuff on the recording that I didn't want any of my colleagues to hear. So I turned off the recording. And as it turns out, it was all quite tame. But she said something so interesting that I didn't get. So she was working during the Ebola crisis with young people and trying to get them to help change behaviors in Sierra Leone, those behaviors that might encourage transmission. And then after the epidemic, she worked with young people in Sierra Leone to help them work with local government and make local government more accountable and to make it more responsive and to get them involved in the civic and democratic life of their communities. And when she said, like, they would get discouraged, because of course they would, she would remind them about what they did during the Ebola crisis. Look at what young people did during Ebola and how much difference you made. And then that would kind of cheer them up and they would, you know, regain their enthusiasm, because it was all true. And in Sierra Leone, they took away from that experience a kind of confidence that we as the people, we as citizens, we as people who live in our neighborhoods, in our villages, in the city, in our neighborhoods, we're the ones that conquered Ebola. We're the ones that eventually ended transmission because we changed our behaviors, we responded, we did the things, and we built a complicated social infrastructure to fight this illness. And that enthusiasm and confidence carried on. And we were kind of discussing about how that has been absent from the conversation here in the UK, and how it's been a kind of, you do this. And of course, you know, I've heard Boris Johnson, you know, thank you for all your hard work, but it is us who is going to stop the spread of corona or reduce it to a manageable level. It's our behaviors, it's our mutual aid societies that's responding, it's our work, our volunteering. That isn't to say that government and local government don't have a leading and guiding role, but it's us with those local institutions, both formal and informal, that are gonna make those changes to help us now, but also to deliver that reset that we want. And I think I haven't heard that message.
That's fascinating. I guess the person who came closest to that actually was the Queen in one of her addresses, where she sort of talked about, you know, in the future, looking back on this moment as a time when people did do something extraordinary. But I think you're right that hasn't been a mainstay of the sort of public discourse around that. And we certainly haven't yet. And then as far as it has been, it's been about the immediate response. It's been about now. As you say, it's been about staying home. It's been about, you know, getting through this. It hasn't been about what we can build together going forward. So that's really fascinating. That's again, something that needs a lot of thinking about, I think.
Yeah, I think we do need to think about that. And the message around staying home, that makes it sound lazy, but actually we've all upended our lives completely.
Yeah.
And that's not a small thing. Yeah. That's not just sitting on your couch, although that is what it looks like. I mean, I've done a lot of couch sitting. But we have completely changed the way that we work, the way that we engage with other people, the way that we socialize and live our lives. And we should give ourselves a bit more credit, I guess.
I think that's right. And look, we talked a lot over the years at LGIU about local government, you know, the role of local government being to sort of facilitate and capture the civic energy of local people. And I guess this is a scenario in which that really comes into focus, and it becomes very obvious that that's what we have to do. It becomes very obvious that that's the role of public institutions, is to do that. The question then becomes how, and how you sort of both capture and maintain and seed further that energy, which we've undoubtedly seen in communities and indeed in households and in individuals across the country.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that is going to be a big part of our community focus question going forward.
Agreed.
So
yes,
thanks, Mandy.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, these things are designed for, you know, even if no one else listens to this, we've learned something. So that's a bonus. But I hope that you out there have learned something too. I think, you know, a couple of really great interviews there that really set out some of the kind of landscape for how we need to move into the next phase of this. So thank you for listening. We do hope that you will go and check out the framework that we've put on our website.
Sign up as well, because we will be wanting to hear directly from you, and there's a place to sign up there.
Absolutely.
So you just pop your email in, tell us what bits of it you're interested in, and we want to work with you in that community way.
Sure. The whole point of that framework is to have a conversation within it. So yeah, please do sign up for that. And of course, as always, please do give us a rating, leave a review on the podcast using whatever podcast app you use. And we will be back in a fortnight.
Thanks for listening.
Bye-bye.